was like, wow, you know, you can't get any decent food delivered here when you've been boozing. Then I was like, wait a minute, maybe I should start something that is a late night delivery service for food that you can get in like half an hour. You want it from McDonald's or BK. So that was like the initial idea. And I didn't take it very seriously, to be honest. You could say, well, why would you take this job? Well, it's because it's the biggest market in the world and we're early and we're fundamentally changing how people live.
I bet you 50 quid you'll love Pleo. All right, I'm bending the truth slightly, but they're so sure you'll join me as a customer that they've put the money on it. Their smarter spending platform for business expenses is so good that as soon as you've had a demo, they'll give you £50 on their card just to discover how much of a game changer it is. That's right, your next team lunch on Pleo. If you are a leader, secret or not, all you need to do is visit www.pleo.io/leaders and book a demo today.
Will Hsu is about as on-brand a founder of a unicorn company as I think you're going to find. For starters, he's impossibly difficult to get in the studio for an interview, which is, of course, completely understandable and even expected, but rumours about his passionate dedication to the Deliveroo customer cause are the stuff of legend. Rumour has it he still delivers to customers on his bike himself, though not quite as frequently as when he first started. Will, true or false?
Yeah, I mean, I did it every single day for about 9 months in the beginning. But in the last month, I've actually done it quite a few times. I did it in Paris for 3 days and did in Australia for about 3 days. So got a chance to kind of see different markets. I love seeing different neighborhoods, meeting customers, talking to other riders. So it's great.
That definitely explains the tan a little bit more than France.
Do I have a tan? I
think it's very hot.
Yeah, well, that too. We are in a hot room. Now, his incredible company has so far done the seemingly impossible, staving off competition not only from Uber, but Amazon too, who recently invested heavily into the European unicorn in their recent £450 million round, valuing them at over $4 billion. Now, since 2013, it's grown to cover 80,000 restaurants. Still true, or have we grown since then?
That's probably more, but I don't know.
Exactly. Sure. Well, we'll just keep these facts for now and just know that growth is growth. So by the
time...
Where
did you get that valuation number, by the way?
That's a good question. Business Insider?
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't disclose it, but I'm just kind of curious.
Business Insider to the rescue, potentially, or not.
I have no comment.
Okay, fair play. Well, we just have what we read. Don't believe everything you read, folks. They've got 60,000 riders and around 2,500 employees around the world. It operates in over 500 cities in 14 countries. Still right? So to date...
We're in 13 markets. 13, not 14.
God damn it. Right, which one of these is not right? Australia, Belgium, France, Germany,
Hong
Kong.
We're not in Germany.
Not in Germany. Yeah. All right, let's do this again then.
You were in Germany, right?
We were in Germany. Yeah, we exited Germany.
Okay, yeah. Fine. So
we might go back. We don't know.
For now,
yeah.
Australia, Belgium, France, Hong Kong, Italy, Ireland, Netherlands, Singapore, Spain, Taiwan, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and the UK. Excellent. I get a nod. You can't see it, but it's a nod. We're excited to have him in the studio with us today. And whilst it's the end of the day and he's not actually brought us any dinner, which is a bit rude.
I could.
He could. There's many things he can do. Well, we'll get order in. That seems quite reasonable. I'm going to let this one slide, though, so we can get cracking into what I hope is a cracking interview, Will. So thanks for joining us this evening. We'd like to kick things off with a quick fire round. So you ready with that?
Sure.
Okay. Favorite takeout food?
Favorite restaurant or favorite type of cuisine?
Favorite type of cuisine.
Probably Chinese.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Go on. You must have a favorite Chinese in London.
I mean, it
London,
depends
then.
On kind of what neighborhood you're in. But in this neighborhood, you guys are in Soho.
Yeah.
I love Manga Fried Chicken, which is this Taiwanese fried chicken place right in Chinatown. It's really unique. The skin's almost like tempura. It's very thin, but very crispy. Really recommend it.
What's your holiday destination of choice?
I haven't really...
What's a holiday, he wants to say.
To be honest, I'm just anywhere where, you know, I can chill out. So
Where can you chill out? When's the last time you went on a holiday and chilled out?
Yeah, like when I go for work to some of these cities, I get to see these cities and, you know, check out different neighborhoods and have fun. So, yeah.
But I feel like that's a relevant question, actually. Have you, like, in the last few years, have you had an opportunity to just relax somewhere?
Yeah. Not like a ton, but... I went to Vietnam for a few days in between going to Hong Kong and Australia. So I had a few different work trips there. So that was pretty cool.
Okay. Got an easier question for you.
Yeah.
Tea or coffee?
I like green tea.
Fair
but
way.
I drink one black Americano in the morning always.
Okay. You sound like someone who's a regimented time or something.
No, I just got into it. I don't know. I don't need coffee, but it's kind of nice to have in the morning.
All right. And UK, USA, Taiwan?
So I'm American. I was born in the U.S., but I've lived here since 2004, with the exception of business school, and I, you know, absolutely love it here. This is home.
Okay. I feel like he's kind of saying UK, which we will, if he didn't say it, then we're going to put those words in his mouth. All right. You grew up in Connecticut. So, someone who obviously has a clear entrepreneurial streak, like you say, started in 01, like, you know, obsessing around this idea. So, you've always wanted to do something like this. And the idea for Deliveroo and the sort of market problem that you identified hit you really early, as I've read. So take us back before then. What kind of upbringing does someone have to sort of spark this curiosity and desire to build?
Pretty normal. I grew up in a place called New Haven, Connecticut. It's a city of, I don't know, 130,000 people, probably 9 square miles. So pretty small place. It's famous for a university there, Yale University. And my mom worked there. And my dad also worked around New Haven as well. So just kind of grew up there. I mean, pretty normal, honestly.
And then siblings?
Yeah, I have a little sister. Yeah. And then went to Chicago for university. I went to a place called Northwestern. And then, so it's 4 years there. And then in 01, moved to New York, started working, you know, in finance. So investment banking analyst at Morgan Stanley. That's how I discovered food delivery, because I worked 100 hours a week and every single meal I consumed in the office. And we didn't have internet ordering. I mean, you guys are, I don't know how old you guys are, but probably a lot younger. And we used to call up the places and give them our credit card details and order on the phone. And then one of my first duties as an analyst was to take physical menus and alphabetize them and collate them by cuisine. So that's just how it worked.
Well, as in a boss of yours asked you to do
that? Yeah, my first week. Yeah.
Well, as like an intern or a graduate?
No, as a graduate, I was like, wow, this is, you know.
I had exactly that, but I was 10 years after that, 2001. I was doing exactly the same thing in like 2009 when I was at
bank. They had the internet when you were around.
Yeah, I know, but they didn't have anybody to pick that up. So I actually had to go and phone in the order, read out the credit card details, and then I got sent down to Wagamama to go and pick up their cashier
cards. I got it. Yeah. The thing about New York, though, was that every restaurant delivered, so you could get, you know, high end, low end, it didn't matter. And so you had this like really thick booklet of places. And so, you know, come 8, 9 p.m., you would sit there with your colleagues and be like, all right, what are we having? And you'd get your card out and kind of order food. And then it became part of your personal life too, because any New Yorker will tell you, I mean, food delivery has been going on in New York since the 1950s, right? It's not like a new thing, because the population density, the restaurant density, the grid system of streets, and then the fact you have doormen everywhere means that delivery just works really well, because you can just leave it with a doorman usually. And these are things I never thought about until I moved here. But yeah, you could get a steak, you could get a sandwich, you could get an omelet, you know, it didn't matter. And so that was really cool, but it was just part of, you don't think about it much if you live in New York. And then I got transferred here in 04. And that things were different here.
Okay, so just to get like an idea, do you think that if you started Deliveroo in New York, it just never would have taken off because it's just not a problem?
New York would be the last place I'd start Deliveroo. Although, you know, DoorDash, Uber Eats, Postmates are there.
That's what I was going to ask, yeah. It's
but, so there are restaurants that don't do it, but it's just really easy to deliver food in New York. Like, you just walk 4 blocks and you're done, right? But yeah, I'd say New York is definitely the anomaly in the U.S.
Okay. So 2001, you say, you came to the U.K.?
No, 04.
Oh, 2004. Okay, fine. So
yeah, July 04.
Got it.
Canary Wharf. Yep.
July 04, Canary Wharf. First impressions as a starting point?
So I never lived outside the U.S. You know, I never traveled much. Just grew up, you know, kind of where I grew up. And
do we speak funny to you?
No, I'm thinking like, yeah, I wasn't like a worldly person, never went on vacation or anything. So I guess I got to the UK. Actually, take a step back. So April 04, Morgan Stanley said, why don't you come and check it out, see if you want to move here. And I came and I met this team at Morgan Stanley who I just really clicked with. And I loved how international the people were, because New York is a very international city, but London is definitely more international because of Europe, but also the professional class is more diverse. And so that was great. I met great people. They were like, hey, we're going to go to the pub. I'm like, you guys really do this at like every day.
On a Thursday lunchtime.
Yeah, I was like, I don't really understand. So maybe they were just, showing me a good time, but I really liked it.
No, I'm pretty sure what you've just said is making a lot of sense to a lot of people. That does sound quite normal.
Yeah. I mean, we had to work really long hours, but they took me out. I had a great time, met really great people, and then just decided to move and just moved over in July 04. But what I do remember in regards to food delivery was, I saw it was like second day of work. I'm like, guys, what are we doing for dinner? And they were all like, no, we're going to go to Tesco in the mall and we're going to pick up these microwave meals. And I was like,
You ever discovered depression. You were like, oh, my God.
Well, I'll be honest. The UK microwave meals are delicious.
Yeah,
compared
they are.
Although
Tesco is not exactly the... unprofessional of me to say on a recorded interview, but Tesco is not the microwave meal place of choice. I mean, surely
I remember the first one I had. It was paella.
Right.
And it was like pretty good, but I was like, guys, like you could do better. And everyone's like, what do you mean? I'm like, do you order food for delivery? They're like... No, we just go to the Tesco, and there was a BK and a Tesco and our Chili's, so we would rotate between the boneless buffalo wings at Chili's, Whoppers at BK, and then the Tesco, and I just thought, there could be more variety.
Did they? There used to be a service called Deliverance. Do you remember those guys? They did a deal with a load of banks where they almost like a bank could have like a Deliverance portal.
Were they the posh ones, Deliverance? They did like only high end meals.
They did like it wasn't like
they cooked their own.
They cooked their own food. It was like they had a central.
But
kitchen.
It was pretty good. Like I remember, like they had a nice cardboard carrier package and. No, I used to use it. I thought it was really great. And then Domino's, of course, was the other one, which I still love, honestly. But yeah, so you can...
Yeah, you still order Domino's?
I mean, like, I haven't in a while, but I actually really like it.
Yeah,
it's quite a
I like the chicken
product.
Kickers. And it's not very healthy, but...
Well, I mean, yeah, it's pizza, but, it's a cheat meal.
Two for Tuesdays. Okay,
hey,
it's Monday.
Oh, shit. Okay.
We could order one.
Yeah, shame. I like that we're not able
but
to actually consider just buying full-price pizzas.
That was kind of the delivery scene back then, when I got here. And I don't even think Just Eat wasn't even around back then, I think.
No, I don't think they started at that point.
Or maybe they just launched or something.
Yeah, because we've had David Buttress on the show.
Yeah.
And I guess, did they play like an early inspiration for... I mean, obviously it's a different product, but like did they play an early inspiration in terms of... I mean, they kind of pioneered in the UK like the opportunity in the first place.
Yeah, I think they played a role that maybe is different than what you're imagining, which is, when I first tried Just Eat, I thought I was going to get this amazing experience with restaurants I knew and I wanted to order from, and also I could like get the food quickly. But what I found was that it was, places I'd never heard of. I would call the restaurants maybe anonymous. So the anonymous Chinese place, Indian kebab, fried chicken, pizza place. And then I had no idea when the food was going to show up. So for me, it actually didn't feel like a great consumer experience. And this was in 08 when I first tried it.
Sure.
But then ultimately, they've been hugely successful. So obviously that's kind of worked. But, for me, getting food from restaurants I know and love and getting it in like 25 minutes is pretty important. And to be able to track the order and all that stuff.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it seems strange now being here and imagining that that's innovative, to have been able to order food from the brands you're already familiar with on the high street. But then so many of the guests that we have on the show and the businesses they built, they are really incredibly obvious opportunities. Just no one's gone through the hard pain of figuring out how it would happen. And obviously in your case, like the logistics is just a complete, mindfuck. It's just so complicated to imagine how we started there. So I guess that brings us on to the exciting bit, which is the acorn of an idea that is Deliveroo and how you actually got going with it.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, the idea, like anyone who's 8 years old could come up with it, right? So it wasn't really a novel idea. But the genesis actually starts in 08. I was trying Just Eat. And I admit that when I was trying
Every great idea happens in a recession, they say, right?
Well, I was with friends and, we'd been out and, we'd get back to my place and I just kept complaining. I was like, wow, you can't get any decent food delivered here. When you've been boozing, right? And so then I was like, wait a minute, maybe I should start something that is a late night delivery service for food that you can get in like half an hour. You want it from McDonald's or BK. So that was like the initial idea. And I mean, I didn't take it very seriously, to be honest, but that was the idea. And then I actually tried starting Deliveroo, or talked about starting Deliveroo with who would be my co-founder, Greg. He grew up with me in New Haven together. And so I was like, and he wasn't in London, but I was explaining to him, I'm like, hey, you know, there's these restaurants people want food from. They want it quickly. There's a marketplace model called Just Eat, but they don't deliver the food. So we'd have to build up a courier network and try to make that work. And so we were thinking about it. And he was like, yeah, I think we'd have to put a fax machine or a laptop in each restaurant. And then we'd have to develop some sort of Palm Pilot type device, or somehow, you know,
a pager.
A pager, get the guy's Nokia to work. I mean, the iPhone 1 had come out in 07. I think SDK came out in 08. So it was not clear what that, you know, what the iPhone would represent, and tablets and all of that. So what, you know, Steve Jobs created, I think, can never be understated in terms of like the impact on the world, right? And so without those devices, none of the stuff today would exist.
Okay, so talk to us about the first days of Deliveroo.
Thinking back on it, let me think here. So graduated business school, was just home in New Haven for a bit. So Greg actually grew up there too. So we're talking about the business. He was living up in Boston, so I would take the train up there and kind of spend time with him. And then I was like, okay, gonna move out to London. So I guess that was September 12th. Man, so yeah, 7 years ago. About 7 years ago. Feels like it's about 50, if I'm honest. But
yeah. No surprise.
Moved out here. And so I was here alone. And so we would kind of Skype and do stuff over Skype. And then he then came out after developing the product more, probably around Jan. And so he was just living in my flat. But it was pretty funny, actually. My flatmate, Forrest, great guy, also a friend of mine from business school, he was just like, when is this guy leaving? He can't just stay here for months. Yeah. You know, so Greg just be on the couch, yeah. And you know, Forrest be like, "What are you doing?" And then launched.
What was your rebuttal?
I just kind of ignored him.
Yeah, exactly. Chill out.
I was like, "Hey, man, don't worry. It's okay." Yeah. He's like,
"It's
not
student
okay.
lifestyle."
Yeah. So then basically started talking to restaurants, trying to get all this set up, getting the marketing materials ready, and then. You know, like doing stuff like talking to the payment processors, you know, stuff like that, getting a bank account set up, which was like the biggest pain in the ass ever here.
Yeah, it is. It is bad.
I mean, I couldn't do it. I had to use my personal one for a long time.
This podcast is brought to you by Klaviyo, the growth marketing platform most recommended by other business leaders. And last year, 67 new brands switched to Klaviyo every single day. From a shopper's first impression to each subsequent purchase, Klaviyo understands every interaction, empowering brands to create more personalized marketing moments. When you have a 360-degree view of your customer, the growth possibilities are endless. Klaviyo truly understands how challenging it is for each and every entrepreneur to get their business off the ground. The cost of acquiring new customers is continuing to rise. Brands are experiencing diminishing returns, as well as a small audience reach. Their marketing efforts are continually being squeezed. But Klaviyo is helping brands take back control by leveraging their own marketing channels like email, web, and mobile to provide exceptional customer experiences. Klaviyo continues to help hundreds of thousands of business leaders just like me grow globally. Visit klaviyo.com/leaders. That's klaviyo.com/leaders today to find out more. Now back to the show. Do you remember who the first restaurant you pitched was and who the first ones that said yes were?
I definitely remember the first restaurants that said yes. I think they were the first ones I pitched. So we started the business on the King's Road in Chelsea, basically. And so the Stockpot was a restaurant, and I used to live above it. And so the owner, Angelo, great guy, you know, he'd always just hang out. We'd have a glass of wine, talk, and he was like, hey, what have you been up to? And I was like, oh, I was in business school for a few years. I'm back here. Here's what I'm trying to start. And he's like, well, it seems like a pretty bad idea. And I was like, well, why? And he's like, well, why wouldn't someone just come pick it up from the restaurant? And I'm like, because they're lazy? I'm like, it seemed like pretty obvious to me. And then he's like, fine, you want to try it out? You can put the tablet in here, put a printer here, like whatever. Like, I'll be your test pilot. So that was restaurant one. unfortunately closed down, the stock pot. It was a famous place on the King's Road for a long time. It was a calf.
Mm.
And then there was Rosa Pomodoro on the Fulham Road. And Mario was their marketing manager. He's a great guy. And he kind of was like, he wanted to do delivery himself. And then he was just sort of like, okay, like if you're going to do it, like let's see how this goes, right? And the third one was Busaba on the King's Road.
Busaba.
Yeah, it was great. And there were chains. So was Rosa Pomodoro, but Mario was the decision maker. There was this one waitress there called Kinga. And I remember her really well. She was like the smartest like person. And she was like a waitress, but she would spend time with me. I'm like, hey, I want to show you how this works. And she got really intrigued. And she was like, okay, you know what? We do a lot of like takeout, but this could really drive sales. And so she talked to the head office and took forever, but eventually those were the three first restaurants we got on. And so I used to walk up and down the King's Road, Fulham Road, Old Brompton Road, you know, Old Church Street, and just talk to restaurant owners. So New Culture Revolution was another one. It's still on. It's doing really well.
And were they doing delivery already, or were they?
So no, not really, right? Busaba wasn't. Rosa Pomodoro. I remember like Mario telling me, he's like, in the accent, I probably shouldn't do that. But he's like,
probably should. Go, Will.
He's like, Will, this is not going to work because Neapolitan pizza, you can't, it's not like delivery, right?
And
it's
I mean, I don't know Mario, but I mean, you nailed it.
Mario actually doesn't sound like that, but this other guy in the place did. I have a lot of Italian friends, so hopefully they're.
Hopefully it sounded like one of them.
Yeah, it sounds like all of them. Yeah, so it was just kind of wandering those streets because, like, you know, we were just in one neighborhood for the first probably 3 months of operations. Yep. So starting from Feb 13 to May 13, we were in one neighborhood and, you know, I was doing deliveries every night. So I had a scooter, you know, and then I started recruiting scooter drivers as well, just kind of talking to them on the street, being like, hey, you want to join Deliveroo? And they're like, who are you?
Yeah.
Like, what do you want?
Yeah.
And so the early days was, there was about three or four riders. There was Mirza, there was Hanif, there was Saeed, and there was Matlub, and we used to just wait in the Starbucks in the Royal Chelsea. No, sorry, not the Chelsea Westminster Hospital.
Right. Okay.
That one on the Fulham Road.
Like a little motley crew with your bikes ready.
Oh, we were definitely a motley crew because we didn't have any business, right? So we were just sitting there like waiting for orders, and we had this. I mean, what we had really. So we had a consumer website. And Rich will tell you it was just a website. We didn't have an app. It was not mobile optimized. So you'd have to kind of zoom in to the checkout button to actually transact. So that was funny. We actually built a decent restaurant tablet. That was pretty good. And then our rider app, we basically just had – we tried to build something – because most of the riders had Android phones. So we built something in titanium that ideally would work on both iOS and Android, but – kind of like didn't work on either, if I'm honest.
And was Greg doing all of this?
Greg was doing this. Yeah. And yeah, it was just me and him, I guess. Yeah, at that point. Oh. Yeah. So Greg was the single-handedly most productive person you can like work with, right?
Yeah.
Across the that's like full stack development across everything there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. On Skype and or in my like living room. It was a lot of fun though. Like it was just like the two of us. And then we'd sit there like waiting for orders.
Do you remember having like a good rapport with the other driver? Like, what was it like? Was it kind of like fun and like camaraderie, or was it kind of like at, like more so for you because it's your business, and for them they're kind of just waiting around for something to happen?
Yeah, I'm just thinking back, right? No, they were really all really nice guys, right? So we had nothing to do, so we just chat to each other most of the time, right?
Do they still ride?
Yeah, Hanif does. Saeed does.
Must be some quite cool pride being like, no, I was the first.
I mean, I see them. Yeah, I try to have lunch with Hanif and Saeed. Mirza moved back to Pakistan.
Okay.
I don't know where Matlub is. I actually learned some pretty interesting things from them because there was the Starbucks. So we would always get kicked out of the hospital one because it closed like at 8, I remember. Mm-hmm. And there was one across the street that's like a smaller Starbucks, and we'd go in there. And every day, like, the guy would kick us out. And I was always like trying to understand why, because we would buy stuff and they're like, no, you guys got to go. Like, you can't just sit in here all day. And I guess it was probably the first time in my life that, you know, someone, how do I describe this? looked at me in a way, I don't know if disdain is the right word, but maybe just very indifferent maybe is the right word. And, you know, because it's me and like three Pakistani guys, and like I was kind of getting mad this guy was kicking us out all the time, right? These dudes were just like, hey, man, just go, like whatever. And I just realized that, you know, these guys probably deal with that like every day, you know? So I don't know what my point is, but I think it was just like – it just made me like
just think, something to prove.
Well, no, just like – no, no, not like that. Just like these people, you know, they were seen as anonymous is probably the best way to put it, right? Mm. And they weren't treated with respect or dignity. And but they were so used to it, you know? That just kind of made me sad a bit.
So you've got four writers. You've got – a handful of restaurants in Chelsea.
Yeah.
And you've got, what is this, like over the course of a year, you've kind of like started to get going?
Yeah. So let's see. So month three, yeah. We actually end up going to Mayfair. We call that MMS, Mayfair Marylebone Soho. So that's where we launched.
Right.
And so we started kind of, I remember the first big kind of account we had was Blackstone. They started ordering from us. We would do stuff like just hand out flyers on the street. I wore a kangaroo costume like too many times. I really didn't enjoy wearing the kangaroo costume. I still remember the Marylebone Street Fair of 2013. The Real Greek – was that the Real Greek? It was one of those restaurants. I don't remember. Asked me, hey, do you mind wearing the kangaroo costume around to the street fair? And I was like, oh, okay. And I just remember like these – they weren't even kids. These women, they were like 20 years old for sure. And they were like drinking, grabbing my tail like nonstop. And I'm like, listen, do I want to be here in a kangaroo costume?
Was it even delivery branded or was it?
No,
it was just
costume.
A random kangaroo.
It was brilliant with the hat on and everything. The head. Right. So you literally might as well not have been you, which is the best part of
it. Yeah. Well, they were just grabbing my tail and wouldn't leave me alone. And so I was like, okay.
Do you ever whip it out at the Christmas party still?
No, I haven't worn the it just gets me too hot. As you can see, I'm sweating right
That's
now.
That's very
so.
True. Yeah, I cannot really – I mean, imagining you in a kangaroo costume, it feels like animal cruelty in both ways.
definitely for the kangaroo. Yeah, in the summertime. Sure.
Did you so obviously you got started. I mean, to give some background, like we talked about this before the interview, but I was also doing a business very similar to Deliveroo, yeah. And we were kind of like early days – both kind of riding around London doing the same thing. But was there a certain point that you were aiming towards in terms of restaurants signed up or deliveries you were doing before you knew you could go and raise some funding for this? Like having
I was funding it myself, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I did initially. And then I was introduced to a few people who were really, really knowledgeable about the restaurant industry. So they became two of my seed investors, Giles Thorley, who used to run Punch Taverns, and then he was also chairman of Tragus, which owned Bella Italia, Cafe Rouge, and Strada. And the other guy was Graham Turner. He was the CEO of that company. So they were great. And so I was introduced to them, and they were like, hey, let me get your advice about this. And they were like, cool, but like, I would love to invest in the business. And so we raised a tiny bit of money, I think maybe £100,000, something like that, SEIS.
Yep. Yeah.
So my friends invested. And then from there, basically –
and you'd self-funded it until that point.
Yeah. I mean like – and you didn't – like it's not like I didn't take a salary. Greg didn't take a salary. So it's not like it really cost that much to do, right? And we had some – I mean tablets to buy and, you know, some hosting and whatever. Just like wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And then I think I got really excited about the business when we got out to outside of pure central London. So I think it was I want to say Chiswick or Clapham. I don't remember which one.
One of the C's.
In you know the customer engagement numbers were really the same as Central London because I was like maybe this will be a I didn't know right I was like maybe the business is just for kind of people that want like because we were focused on independent restaurants right so we were like maybe that's the scene and maybe that's a central very Central London thing Soho Chelsea Mayfair turns out it wasn't and that's when we got you know really. Confident that this was a much bigger problem we were trying to solve.
So fast forwarding a little bit. So if I'm correct, you raised a £2 million angel round. Was that your first round?
That was Series A.
That was Series A.
Yeah, now these Series A's are much bigger.
Right, yeah, exactly. You get these, like, you know, dickheads being like, I just raised my 10 million seed.
10? Oh, yeah, seed. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so good. So there is an element of normal grounding in the scenario of your fundraising story as well, especially at the start. So,
yeah, I mean, like, I think we kind of raised capital Well, look, I mean, I self-funded it, then raised £100,000, right? Yeah. And then, yes, then sort of, you know, things got more heated, I guess. But indexes around, yeah, I guess it was like, I don't remember, 2.7 million pounds, something like that. And at the time, we were like, holy shit, like, whoa. What do we do with this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember
roughly like how many restaurants you had on board or how many customers, like broadly?
Probably had like 50 restaurants, 100, something like that. We were in five neighborhoods at that point. Sure. So we were in Chelsea, South Cannes, Marylebone, Mayfair, Soho, Shoreditch, the City, Notting Hill, and Islington. So 2013 was me and Greg till I hired Justin, who's our first employee still at Deliveroo, in maybe September, and then Lenny, who I hired in November. So I would just like be on the streets all day.
Yeah.
And Justin would like be out there, you know, selling the thing. But it was actually pretty easy to sell because we had really good technology and it was just like, hey, this is how it works. And people were like, okay, like it's working in Chelsea. Like we'll try it out. So it wasn't a hard sell for people.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, you get to, I guess, the Series A pitch, which you said like about 50 restaurants, right? So I'm imagining you're talking about roughly a big vision pitch, right? As in this is the future of food ordering. Because at that point, I guess, there's not like this ridiculous metrics, but there's like enough to definitely see that that could be the future.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think my pitch probably wasn't like – I don't actually – actually, I'm trying to remember in my head. It was probably about like, hey, like this is just a huge missing piece of food delivery. You have the marketplace model, which I think is an inferior consumer experience. We've unlocked all this demand, not just in Chelsea, but in a few other neighborhoods as well. And our, you know, retention and frequency of these users is really high. It's, I mean, obviously early adopters, but like we didn't market at all. We had no marketing budget and we were just out there. Right, and people were using it.
So how long between that and like things just going completely gangbusters? Well, what was the gap between like your Series A and Series B in terms of how much you raised?
The B, okay, so the A was Jan 14. Yeah, Jan or Feb 14. And the B came a year later.
Okay. And
so that B was to set us up to do international expansion.
And how much did you raise then?
20.
Yeah, okay, so that's a huge jump.
$20,
right?
I think.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Fine. But it's like a roughly 10x jump. And so that's like, you can see all the potential, and suddenly you're moving into other. Did you move to, was it Brighton second?
Brighton and Cambridge were second. And okay. We picked those cities just because they were close enough that we don't have offices in those places. And so we could just send people on the train.
Oh, right, okay. Right? Yeah, fair. And then? Like a few more in England before you went international?
Yeah, we're probably in about five or six cities in the UK. So we opened Manchester, then we actually opened an office there, Birmingham, Leeds. Yeah.
Okay. And then France, second market, or?
Yeah. So we opened Dublin and Paris at the same time.
Okay.
By that point, did you kind of have like a playbook where you're like, we're launching in this city. This is exactly what we need to do. We know we're going to.
Got to get Will in the kangaroo outfit, going knocking on doors, heading into the parties.
I don't know if we had a playbook. Like I had a vision of like how many restaurants a customer should see.
Yeah.
Right. And then like we had a framework for, you know, signing up riders. But remember, like every country was so different, right? Like France had a really different sort of. There were a lot of people on scooters, but like, how do you talk to them and how do you get them excited about this? And then people in Ireland were really different. So. We had a general sense of the customer value proposition, but not exactly how to execute on it.
Okay. And also, like, you know, this is a bit of a nerdy question, but it just sort of made me realize, you know, you must have shifted a lot of supply and demand understanding from within each restaurant. So obviously they're used to covering as many meals as they can cover, and then suddenly you've got Deliveroo and there's all this demand and stuff, so they have to cook more and they have to order more. Did you find that like a was that something you had to engage with them on?
Not initially, because like the way restaurants thought about us initially was like, oh, this is awesome, like I'm getting 5 or 10 more covers a night, cool, great, I don't need to hire any more people, I've already got the chef here, paid for the rent. And that was the pitch, right?
Yeah.
It was like, this is what's happening. And so, no, initially that was never something that people really talked about.
Okay, fine. So
until it became just a much bigger part of the business. Right?
Sure. And then when did you launch Editions?
So Editions, let's see, what is today? September 19. So basically we launched it a little over 2 years ago, right? And the idea behind Editions was our busiest restaurant partners, we were getting to be 20 to 30% of their revenue. And that actually caused operational issues both in the front of house and back of house. And so what I said is I'm going to set up a off-premise kitchen for you, Mr. Restaurant. You can segregate delivery from in-house and focus on both and do both better. But then I realized actually the problem we were solving was much more strategic than that, because essentially what we're doing, in addition to what it is for your listeners, is it's like a warehouse in industrial estate that's segmented into kitchens, and then restaurants take up occupancy in those kitchens, and then they cook the food. We provide a physical infrastructure layer, a delivery layer, and then software layer to operate the kitchen. And so the idea basically was we are actually creating new supply for neighborhoods, right? That's actually what we're doing. We have data that says we think a Thai restaurant at this price point should do well, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
and then so we're
like— I love that. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, so it's a really core part of our strategy.
It makes it super efficient as well. But I guess but there has been some issues in terms of like finding those locations, has there, in terms of like, and some local councils I know have basically objected to that.
Yeah.
But how have you overcome that?
We've had really constructive discussions with the councils and the residents, right?
Yeah.
Because I totally get having a bunch of scooters coming into an area that maybe doesn't even have a lot of residences, but has some, is really a problem, right? And so one area, so Swiss Cottage, we have a site on Finchley Road where we actually, instead of scooters, we only allow bicycles and electric scooters, and that's made a huge difference.
Yeah.
And the council, I think, was much happier about that, right? And then things like, you know, odor reduction and things like that. But we're creating supply for people that don't have it is essentially what we're doing. And we're also allowing restaurants to expand into different areas. And then thirdly, it's a completely different economic model, right? Because you don't have a front of house. Your rent is minuscule compared to what it would be on the high street, right? And so, you know, these things, I think, will become a bigger and bigger part of the eating out economy.
These series and our live events wouldn't be possible without the awesome continued support of LaFosse Associates, the brilliant recruitment partner of choice for us and most our guests. After all, you can't build a great company without great people, and that's why great people trust LaFosse. Check out www.lafosse.com today.
So in terms of, I guess, growing the business and, you know, you've got like your standard offering, and then you've come up with additions, which is obviously, like you said, there's a supply and demand scenario where you've suddenly got so much demand, you almost need to create the supply. So you're creating new opportunities for restaurants to provide opportunities for their customers. But like in all this sort of growing experience in the background, you've got the dreaded Uber launching in the market. And can you take us through behind what was happening at Deliveroo at the time? Was there this kind of like fear? Was there this opportunity? How did you guys respond to that? Do you remember the kind of emotions?
I'm trying to actually think about, I'm trying to remember all the competitive context from not just them, but before, right? So, you know, when we first launched, it was Rich's company, and then there was a company called Dine In, which was run by this guy, Evan, in London, right? And so kind of there was that, and there was another guy I don't remember anymore. And then Take It Easy became a thing, and then Rocket Internet launched their own thing called Foodora. So we were always like, wow, these Rocket Internet's got so much money, you know, like what are we going to do? And then, of course, Uber launched in our markets probably about 3.5 years ago now. So it's actually been quite a bit of time, because Uber Eats launched as the service where you could like get a meal delivered in 5 minutes. They would actually hold the food in the guy's car. And then like you would just hit a button
and it would show up.
They didn't do it in London, but they did in like SF.
But they had like set meals, didn't they?
Yeah.
It was kind of like,
Yeah. So that's kind of what they did. You know, I think like, you know, anytime a big competitor kind of enters a market, you're like, you know, you get fired up for that, right? Like we're all really competitive people at Deliveroo. And so I think it was actually just pushed us all to get, you know, much better, right? Mm. And because, you know, without competition, like it'd be interesting to understand what this world would look like without competition, because it was really easy for us to differentiate from Just Eat, right? Because they didn't deliver the food. You couldn't track the order. You didn't know when the food was going to show up. That made sense for people. But, you know, when a bigger competitor comes in who's a, you know, really kick-ass technology company, you know, that's pretty motivating for people.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you go back to like in the 60s with the space race in the US, like they're competing in Russia, and that was one of the main reasons why they got there first. I think the world without competition would be far less than the world.
It's definitely, you know, yeah. And so we had the big gorilla Just Eat, and then you have, well, the big gorilla Uber as well.
Yeah, sure.
And then we're sitting there going, okay, like, you know, what do we do? And then I think 16 was sort of the peak of their sort of fundraising, you know, sort of prowess. I don't know if that's true because they kept raising more money, but kind of like they were like a very sort of like feared company. And so I think our teams responded, you know, really well in different markets.
Was there a lot of poaching going on at the time? Did people try and approach your guys to come over to Uber, the dark side?
You mean the restaurants or?
No, for like your employees from Uber.
No one did.
So it wasn't really like that. It was kind of like
maybe they tried.
Fair enough. They had the loyalty to, you know, to hopefully one day see you in a kangaroo outfit again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to stick around for this one. It's going to happen, guys.
Yeah.
As you kind of grown to this scale and you've obviously hired people early on, has it been difficult on how you managed people kind of as you've grown? Like, obviously, I don't think Greg's with the business anymore, like full time, but maybe him and other people. Like, how was that a challenge in itself, trying to grow people in their own roles as well as the business?
So I would say, you know, getting people to scale at a company that grows this quickly is really challenging. You look for initially maybe a different set of attributes as you would later on. There's some core attributes you always, you know, stick to. But, you know, in the beginning, it's like, what are you looking for? Really scrappy, smart people that can do all multitaskers, right?
And I guess like in your business as well, like low ego. Because, you know, you do the delivery, do all this stuff. There's no sort of like, no, this is my role. I sit here and I do this.
Yeah, it wouldn't work at a 20-person organization for sure.
But I think that's what's really nice about what sounds like your culture. That's a great way of just sense-checking people's ego as well.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so, you know, like, and I hope that persists. But the idea is that over time, a lot of people aren't going to scale with the business. And it's better for them if they leave. It's better for the company if they leave. But that's the hardest conversation you can have because they've given everything at that point. And without them, the company wouldn't exist, right? So how do you reconcile all of that? That's very, very hard.
And how have you dealt with that? Have you had coaches, mentors? Like, take us through, like, the growth story of you personally, like, as a leader. Because it's been 2013 to 2015, okay, like, a little slow or whatever. But then after that, like, so steep. Like, yeah, how do you do that? It's your first time. Like, it's like a home run first time round. So.
No, it definitely doesn't feel like a home run the first time. I haven't really had that. I certainly, like Giles and Graham would be super helpful. I have a board member, you know, that I talk to all the time who founded two large e-commerce companies, but he came later. I would say no. The answer is no, and sort of tried to figure it out myself and fucked up a bunch of times, I'm sure.
And what about management teams around you? Like, how have you selected them? Have you had like a different understanding of what, like, for example, a COO and a CFO needed to be 5 years ago, whereas now you're like, why? Well, I think I got that really wrong, or it's completely different, the shape of what I thought I needed those people to be. How's that kind of progressed for you?
Yeah, you know, I love the team now. It's great. But, you know, it takes time to get there. And like you said, the understanding of a role, like what is a COO? What is a CFO? What does a CTO actually do, right? All these things you actually have to start writing down and being pretty methodical about because it actually just changes a lot too.
Yeah, and I guess you hope in your wild dreams that they are different, right? As in you want that kind of progression to happen naturally. Otherwise, you've stood still for too long.
Yeah, definitely.
Talk to me a little bit about your choice of investors. Like, has it always been like a personal choice? Have you been very like clear about who you want and who you don't, or is, you know, it not quite so black and white like that?
I think it's about personal connection with them, right? You know, do you think they'll be a good partner? Are they going to be supportive? Are they more of a, you know, are they going to be hands-off, hands-on? It's all of these different things, and not one is right or wrong, but you have a set of things you're looking for, and hopefully they match that.
What's been the most difficult investor conversation you've had?
I think my board is very, you know, challenges, you know, us all the time, right? And so I think that I'm trying to think of, like, the most difficult one. No, I'd say, like, every board meeting is like, hey, we're doing this well, we're not doing this well, here's what we can do better. And they push us hard. You know, they push us really hard.
But has there been any sort of like suggestions to like go a certain direction at some point where you're just like, that does not feel right for the company? And like, you've just gone to like loggerheads. Doesn't have to be with an existing investor, so to speak, but even like a prospective one. Have there been those kind of moments?
Not like explicitly like we think you should do this and you have to do this. I mean, ultimately, I think, you know, I'm in charge of the company because they believe in the vision and where we want to, you know, where we want to take the company. And so if it got to that point, you know, that'd probably be a problem.
What would you say was your most stressful day on the job so far?
I mean, I have stressful days all the time. They're pretty normal, to be honest. So I did have – I'm just trying to think through the really early days. I'd say the one that really sticks out is sort of year one, or maybe it was like year 1.5. You know, we were growing super fast and the site just went down for 4 hours. That was pretty stressful. And Greg was in Chicago trying to like figure it out. And I don't remember exactly what the issue – that was pretty stressful. But yeah, I mean this job – like the way I sort of explain this job to people is like, you know, you're changing the way people eat. You're also changing the way people work. You're changing the face of online and physical restaurant retail. There's sort of a regulatory component of the job. Then you've got intense competition that kind of on the same scale as ride sharing was maybe a few years ago, right? And so like you put all that together and it's like, wow, this is like an intense job. And then you could say, well, why would you take this job, right? Well, it's because it's the biggest market in the world and we're early and we're fundamentally changing just how people live. That's really exciting. But not every day is chill, like not at all. Like almost never.
Yeah. Well, what about like, you know, the period, I guess it's a really new period for you. Like there's obviously there's a lot of public, I guess, light on you guys during the whole gig economy thing with the riders.
Yeah.
You guys were under particular scrutiny. Do you feel like that's because you were like the big guys that's so obvious to go after you? Do you feel like you had more share of that limelight in the press than your competitors? Like, how do you view that now? And also just as a person, having built this company with this vision, this passion, clearly also the camaraderie with your early riders and stuff, you know, you're not, by any sounds of it, like the type of guys like, oh, they're just my riders. Like you were doing that with them. So did you not feel personally attacked, irritated, like such a new experience for you emotionally? How did you deal with that period?
Yeah, look, we were a really small company at that point. I don't think we communicated things really well and things probably could have been avoided if I'm honest. And then, yes, we were kind of the growing company and we got attention from it. But honestly, you know, I don't feel personally attacked. I mean, the way I sort of think about it is there are fundamental things I believe in and I don't really care what the media says. It's not – I mean, if someone tells me to read an article, I'll read it. But like ultimately, what do I care about? Well, I know our riders want flexibility. There's no way we could have 150,000 people working around the world if they didn't value that, right? And what does that mean? That means the ability to log in and out. I want to work for Uber. I want to work for Amazon. I can do all that. I can go to the pub instead of showing up. Like all of that stuff. There's no way that exists without flexibility. Number two is pay, right? And so, you know, like in the UK, we pay well above, you know, the national living wage and minimum wage. And then the third part is really around benefits, right? And this is where like I have a personal passion for. And I'm not a politician. I'm not a lawyer. So I can't really explain this outside of from a technical basis. This is just how I feel. You know, the average delivery rider in the UK works with us about 14 hours a week, right? A lot of them are students, 50, 60% of them are students. The barriers to entry are super low. You need a bicycle and a phone, right? So it's different than being an Uber driver where you need a car, petrol, TFL, license, all that stuff, insurance, right? And so the way I think about it is if you work with Deliveroo 40, 50 hours a week, I want you to have benefits that are akin to an employee, even though you're not an employee, because you can choose never to turn up if you want, right? Now, if you work for Deliveroo 4 to 5 hours a week, my view is that you shouldn't have those rights, right? And I don't know how that gets into law. Like we're talking to different governments and trying to formalize this trade-off or eliminate this trade-off between flexibility and security, that which seems to exist, right? That's ultimately how I feel about it. And so when I talk about it, I'm passionate about it, but it comes from a place of I know the riders. I've done that job for a year. And I think that when people say, well, everyone should be an employee, that's not the right way to think about it because that's not actually what they want.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And then I guess in different countries you're launched in, like France, for example, is quite renowned for having different employment laws than in the UK and many different countries. That is always going to be a challenge. Every you know, market you launch into is understanding that, I guess.
That's the regulatory part of it. And, you know, you want to make sure you're on the right side of that. But also you want to have constructive conversations with regulators and explain this is what we're trying to do, and politicians, because ultimately you don't want everything to be settled in the court of law. You actually want governments to recognize there's a new way of working.
And what about relationships? Like, have you been able to, like, romantically, like, your friends, your family, like, how has building Deliveroo into this big company affected that?
It's harder, right? I mean, you just don't have as much time to see people. But I think, I mean, to your point about actually how do you cope with, you know, this stuff, I think making time for that, you know, is incredibly important. But it's not easy, right? Because your days can be pretty volatile. But yeah.
Is any day the same? Like, you hear some founders like Jack Dorsey will focus on like product one day, on strategy next. What is it like for you? Do you go in and be like, I know that Mondays is media or PR, yeah, or whatever?
No. And I'd say that's one of my big challenges, right? Because I'm not a professional executive. So I was actually having this conversation with one of our board members, Daryl. He founded Blue Nile and Zulily, two big e-commerce companies. And he was kind of giving me shit about being disorganized around certain things. It was good, actually. But he was like, look, man, you're a founder. You're going to be disorganized. Like, otherwise, you wouldn't have started a company. Like, people that are hyper-organized probably don't do that, right? And he's like, he had to learn how to get more organized and just be really regimented about planning out the week, right? And so those are like some of the things I'm trying to do. But I don't have like the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday thing yet, but I'm, you know, that's something I'm working on, because, you know, you're a founder too. You guys are founders. Like, you'll jump into problems and go really deep, but sometimes that's actually not that helpful.
Yeah.
Right.
And what about weekends?
I mean, I try to hang out with people, you know, but I work a lot.
What's your best day at Deliveroo? Do you have like a moment where you were like, God, this is just fucking, this is the zenith?
I have so many days like that.
Today,
so many days
this moment, obviously, this interview.
This moment's probably the pinnacle of my career. But I'd say if I'm on, like, okay, I'll tell
that
you.
That would have been a great soundbite if Rich hadn't laughed through
Sorry.
It.
Sorry. Do it again. That was really awkward.
Do it again. Yeah. I think for me, what I love more than anything is primary research, talking to customers, talking to riders, talking to restaurants, and doing that in different markets. And that really energizes me. And just understanding, like, what are the problems they face and how can we solve them? Like, that to me is, like, super motivating. Seeing a team build product that, like, they thought 2 months ago was impossible is, like, super motivating to me. Seeing team members, like, we talked about how, yeah, like, it's tough for people to scale, but then the people that do and they rise to leadership positions, they prove maybe my initial intuition wrong is super rewarding. So I'd say, like, I have so many great days, right? I mean, and they're all super varied.
I think I've been to your office a couple of times, and obviously having started our business at the same time, started yours.
Were you invited, or is this more competitive research? You wear a fake moustache.
He's going to go through the NDAs now. He's going
to
make sure.
You have to sign one.
I know. I did. But you know, I know your new offices by Cannon Street. Well, not new now, but they were at the time.
Two and a half years.
Beautiful offices. Got like a basketball court in the center. But
it's not a basketball court. Everyone says it is.
It's got basketball.
I saw a photo and I was like, that's a cool basketball court.
So. It's like an all hands pitch.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, famous all-hands pitch that everyone's incredibly familiar with when they see a photo of it.
But you must sometimes
it's my favorite game.
Even I walked through that, I was like, wow, you know, you guys have achieved a lot. Like, you go from like where you came from working with Greg, you know, just the two of you, and then walking into an office like that and just seeing everybody working on the same thing. And it's like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know what? It's cool to see everyone kind of like working towards that thing. The office thing doesn't really, like, it doesn't matter to me that much.
No.
Like, our first office, we didn't have windows or heating
on
Cleveland Street. And frankly, that was great. I love that.
That must be why you like this room so much.
Well, this room has a lot of heat, but no windows. So a little bit different.
Yeah. Did you do that to get talent then, in terms of like, if you're not that bothered about that as the founder, what was the reason for getting a great office?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, you also want to be in a place where there's transport links and things like that, right?
They are on a train station.
We're on Cannon Street Station, right? So we're above the train tracks. No, but we're really lucky to be in that, you know, beautiful office. But like, honestly, if we were like, you know, in a scrappier place, that wouldn't bother me at all.
You know? Talk to us before you go about the Amazon deal. So if you've got, you know, a couple of minutes for it, it's probably not the quickest story, but who approached who? How did that even come up? Because I know that they were looking into, I mean, there was a lot of noise about them doing something like this 2 or 3 years ago. And there's just like a lot of, like, I guess, flirting in the media about doing it, but never really seemed to go anywhere.
Yeah, I don't know what any of those media stories were about, honestly. Was introduced to them at a conference and, you know, just started chatting, and then kind of one thing led to another and it became an investment. That was it.
Was it like a particularly strategic investment, or is it more like this is the deal we're doing and they seem like a very sensible partner amongst other sensible partners as an opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. And certainly they're incredibly, I mean, the most successful sort of e-commerce an operations company in the history of mankind. So that's good.
Yeah. Do you probably learn something.
Did you get any particular like access or insights into things that the rest of us mere mortals would just never know about Amazon? What are they really working on?
Can't tell you.
Can't tell us. Yeah, exactly.
No, the reality is I don't.
It sounds much cooler just to be like, you didn't sign the NDA, Dan. So coming to a close now. So for other entrepreneurs suitably inspired and looking to follow in similar footsteps to you, what do you think the most meaningful insight you can offer to them about how to prepare for a big old growth journey like this is?
Ooh, I would definitely try to get a mentor that's done it before. I think I didn't have that. I think that would be probably really helpful. Is it about starting a company or the growth journey?
The growth, actually.
I think understanding that you will not be able to plan for what happens is pretty important, and just being okay with that. I'm luckily that kind of personality. I think the third part is, like, there will be team members that, you know, don't scale, and it's better for the company and better for them that you part ways, but it is super, super hard, and just be aware of that. And then I'd say the fourth thing across all of this, just be incredibly consumer obsessed. Like, just put yourself in the shoes of the customer constantly. Because if you lose that, then you kind of lose everything.
Considering you probably spend a lot of time thinking about this, what does the future of the gig economy actually look like? And, like, where does Deliveroo's place in that market exist?
Yeah, I think I talked earlier about kind of my ideal state. And that state is ending this trade-off between flexibility and security, giving people who are contractors or whatever new classification they want to call it, the right to have things like holiday pay, sick pay, pensions, but doing that in a way that doesn't compromise their flexibility. And I talked about 130,000, 150,000 people, you know, logging in every day to do this job. That would never happen if they're working on, like, sort of 8-hour shifts. And that's fundamentally, like, the issue. I want to offer all those things, but I can't compromise the flexibility. Otherwise, they don't want that.
Completely get it.
That's my view. I'm sure there's other opinions, but feel pretty strongly about it.
Well, thank you for sharing yours on the show. Well, it's been awesome to have you.
Cool. Thanks,
guys.
Hope
you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I have. Thanks.
What do the founders of Calm, Planet Organic, Photobox, Moonpig, Shazam, Mumsnet, Last Minute, WeTransfer, Allbright, and the School of Life all have in common? They all put their brain first and start their day with Heights. Heights is the smart supplement for brain health and cognitive performance using plant-based natural ingredients designed to help you thrive. Listeners of this show can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com. Well, that's all from us this series. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Rich and I put together the whole show for free. We've got no employees, we've got no salary, we take nothing from it, and we both run our own startups full time. So this really is our side hustle adventure. And we're pretty proud to say it's become Europe's number one business podcast, overtaking How I Built This, Tim Ferriss, and all those other guys. It only took us 4 years, but we got there, and obviously we're pretty chuffed with the outcome. Now, if you want to follow us on our journey building our own startups and indeed making Series 5 behind the scenes, then you can at Dan Murray Serta and at Rich Martell on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Now, as for Series 5, we'll be back with another blockbuster guest list, which is already in the works. A huge thank you to our sponsors, who, thanks to your activity as listeners, means we've secured all three once again to pay for Series 5. So thank you to Pleo, Klaviyo, and Lafos for all your support. Now, as you will have heard, I've been making my own new startup, Heights, which you can check out at www.yourheights.com and at yourheights on Instagram. And I'm delighted to say many of our guests on the show have come in as investors. So there's an unintended but glorious reality for the magic that can happen if you start a podcast.
Now, to that note, if you ever want to start your own, I've written an article on how we did everything, from starting up with £200 to beating Tim Ferriss to the number one spot, which you can find pinned to my Twitter feed. Finally, a huge thank you to Christina Katz for the beautiful designs, Hannah Russell of Mags Creative for the brilliant PR and marketing support, Harry and Daniel at Lower Street Media for editing, and all of you, our fans, for listening and attending our many live events. We've got one left on May the 5th, so grab a ticket at secretleaders.com/live, and now it's finished. Please do take a moment to go on social and tell your friends about Secret Leaders. It's the only way we grow. Thanks for everything, guys. It's been a pleasure. We'll see you later this year for Series 5. And remember, tune in or you'll miss out.